Welcome to Two's Talk with Tosh, Dino, and Donnie.
Joining us today, another fantastic instructor with the 222s program. Welcome, Razor.
Thank you.
Dino, Tosh, good to have you again.
Donnie.
Yeah, good to be back.
Today, we want to talk a little bit about the individual skills that you put onto your instructors to help, you know, specialize everyone's skill set in the game. So we're going to let Dino talk about pitching, because I think if anyone has ever heard the name, they know that's the guy to be talking pitching. Razor is a famous catching whisperer, I would even call him.
And
catcher whisperer.
Yeah. And
I like that.
Well, it's not bad.
He doesn't whisper very much.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, that's a
not very often. No,
yeah, that's an obvious ironic statement. But I mean, he could teach me to catch, I'm sure, and that's crazy to think about. And then hitting, we'll get into. Easy now, Razor. I'm your roommate. Look out for me. I'm looking out for you. And then we'll get into hitting and Tosh, that's your specialty, obviously. So we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll get into some specific examples. But first, let's talk a little bit about the philosophy, the overlying philosophy you have as a coaching staff individually. Dino, we'll start with you. Pitching, tell me a little bit about how you prepare for a practice, a lesson, and with your how it changes with age group. Obviously, you work with everyone from U10 to U19. You've got to have a different philosophy, I assume, working with each individual age group.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, like obviously, where you focus your attention is gonna have a big impact on what age your player is. But we kind of have the same philosophy. Like everything that we do on the pitching side of it, you know, we always talk about anybody that's been at a 222s camp or clinic or winter training or whatever, we always work on the pitching side is five steps that every great pitcher does, right? And those five steps, you know, there's subsection A, subsection I. There's a lot of different things in these steps. You see how I kind of showed that out, Tosh?
Yeah, that was good.
Impressed with that? Okay.
Yeah, subsection.
Subsection. So I was waiting for you to jump on me, but you didn't, so I appreciate that.
No.
So what we do with that is basically, you know, everything that we do in those five steps, it works back to creating a big circle, because if we have a big circle, we're going to throw the ball harder, simple as that. And we try to make it real simple for the kids. So, and the more up the middle of that circle goes of your body, the better you're going to be with throwing the ball where we want. So it's going to help us with accuracy. So all those five steps is really to create a big circle that comes up the middle of our body. And the reason why we've done that is because that's where I seem to see a lot of the mistakes come. You know, the big question of whether or not do I bring the ball with my glove up the middle of my body, or do I bring my arm, do I have a big arm swing? All those kinds of things all plays into that. But for me, if I see a kid, a young player that brings their arm back and it's actually twisting their body and doing some things that are going to hurt maybe steps 3, 4, and 5, then I might suggest, you know, let's simplify it, strip everything down, and let's come up the middle of our body without the big arm swing. And most cases, and I've told this to the last group, few groups that I've seen, is in the last 3 years, I don't have one pitcher that throws the ball harder because they bring their arm back. Is that that's a pretty surprising statement.
It is.
What do you mean by arm back?
The backswing.
When they bring their arm back, you know, rather than just coming from with ball and the glove up the middle of their body, if they separate their hands, I haven't had one person, and that's the main reason that these kids will do that. You know, I'll ask some of them, I'll say, well, why do you bring your hand back? Some of them say, I don't know. My parents taught me. My coach taught me. You know, I just did this. Some of the answers I'll say, you know, well, why do you do it? Well, I can throw harder that way, right? And so when we actually get the radar out and strip everything down and just have them come up the middle of their body without the big back arm swing, there hasn't been one kid in 3 years throw slower because we took that arm swing out of there. So to me, that is not tied to how hard we throw the ball. To me, it's more about the rhythm. And if they've done that arm swing for a lot, you know, a long time, so maybe they're 16, 17, 18 years of age, it's going to be a lot harder for them to make that changeover. But the younger kids are, the more I encourage them to keep the ball and the glove right up the middle of the body, because that's where all the issues seem to start happening.
Well, and the side of, like, the side benefit obviously is when you swing your hand back as you advance, you put different grips on the ball. And as any good coach will tell you, they're trying to look and see, oh, the finger's up, it's a rise ball, or the knuckles are in, it's a change up, or they're holding it on different seams, it's a curve ball. We want to make sure that we're as deceptive as possible when we're pitching. We want to keep the hitters off balance. And if we're showing the pitch before it comes, I mean, any of us who've ever hit the, if you knew it was coming, you'd have a lot easier time taking a hack at it, right? So
yeah.
I think, like you said,
that's right, Donnie, but the thing that is a little bit tricky, it's hard to convince somebody that's 10 years, 11 years, 12 years of age that some coach is trying to, you know, pick their grip and their glove, because it's not happening.
No.
99 out of 100 times, it's not happening. But it's creating good habits when you're 12, that when you're 16, all of a sudden you don't have to worry about that anymore, because that's not even an issue.
Right.
And that, to me, that's the secret, and that's why I'm so adamant that at a young age, we start creating really, really good habits that, you know, when you're 16, 17, you're not going to, have a big major change in dealing with that sort of stuff.
Right, and I think that's the other thing to talk about, too, is the earlier we can look at kids and start working with them, we always, as a coaching staff, say, hey, we're giving you a different way to try it, and it might feel uncomfortable, but work on it. This is what practice is for. So that when you get into that 14, 16, 19 age, we're not having to say, ooh, we're going to have to start from square one again. The more times these kids are exposed to that style of throwing, the easier it's going to be to work with them as they develop up, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Great. So, I mean, obviously we talk about winter training. We talk about team practices, and you work with hundreds, I would assume, of pitchers from varying age, varying skill sets. Tell me a little bit about the base that you want to give them to start, and then you can add pieces to it as you go.
Well, it's a good question, Donnie, but again, age isn't always that, you know, it's more experience, you know, like if you've got a pitcher that's maybe pitched for 3 or 4 years, even at age 10, they're going to be a lot further along than somebody that's maybe just starting at age 10, right? So, I kind of think of it as, you know, the philosophy that I have here doesn't change. It doesn't change if you're 10 or 12 or 14 or 19. Those five steps that we talk about, that's it. I mean, there's no big secret. I could mix it all up and give it to you in different spoonfuls, but it's really to create a big circle and one that comes right down the middle. Now, as you get a little bit older, you know, we start looking at kids that, we get power from our arms, we get power from our hips and our legs, right, our wrist snap. But that leg drive at a younger age doesn't happen nearly as much as obviously when they get a little bit older and start pushing a little bit harder. So to me, that the kids that are in that that stage where they're trying to throw a little bit harder, they have that awkward switch, because what happens is they're going from walking off the mound to now trying to push and drag. And that's a real complicated time. So whether you're 10 or 12 or 14 or whenever that's starting to happen, you know, you have to look at that. And for me, that's the key, the legs. If they're walking off the mound, you know, maybe that's okay when you're 8, 9 years of age. But as you start wanting to push the limits and push the ball a little bit harder, you need your legs. So that push and drive has to be there. And so that's, you know, it's a tough question, but everything, like I say, whether you're 16 or 18, it doesn't matter. I still look at those five steps, and I look at, is your circle big? Can it be bigger? Can we come up the middle of our body a little bit better? Maybe we're starting that circle from our grip, like side of the body, so that circle isn't quite big enough. And so those kinds of things, you know, kind of change individually, right, with each pitcher.
Oh, for sure they do. And I guess my next question would be, in terms of pitching, you've worked with groups probably, you know, individually, and you've worked with groups as large as 15 kids at a time. Is there any message that you start with right off the hop? I mean, we talk about the K being the backbone of how we want to get that position when we open. Is there anything that, as you advance, you talk about that's the key as a progression for these young pitchers coming up?
Well, the K is, you know, you talk about the K, but for me, it's not necessarily the K, because the K is just the back half of that straight circle, right? The K is a real common way that people have warmed up, you know, and I like to incorporate that in our warm-up. But, you know, really, that's just part of every day getting yourself prepared to start throwing, right? So the K is nice. I like using the K because you can kind of break down the pitching motion, and so you can do things like work on spins. You can do things like, you know, if you're working on a specific pitch, you break it down to different sections. And so the K for me, I use it a lot when I'm teaching. And, you know, so it all kind of, but it all goes back to big, you know, the large circle that goes down the middle of your body, right? That's where we all come back to with me.
Okay, and so I want to ask, and I know we'll ask each Razor and Tosh the same thing. Specifically, you've worked with lots of kids. We talked about Jordy Chartrand in the previous podcast about how she's been with the group since she was 11. Probably still had a 3-foot-long ponytail at that age, which is incredible. But her development, let's say you've had her at such a young age, and now she's going into, you know, U19s. Do you talk to these athletes who you have differently as they progress? And tell me a little bit about, as you get into more specified, whether it's spins, whether it's leg drive, whether it's grip, what are you doing with these athletes as they come through the group?
Well, Jordy's a little different because I've actually worked with Jordy for a long, long time. And so there's not a lot of huge changes that we've made. You know, we try to make them small because she did a lot of work 5-6 years ago, right? And so once that form, that's why I think it's so crucial that you start working with kids at a young age, is because you can kind of, you know, that's the nice thing about being an instructor, is you can kind of see kids at 12 and you can see them at 16. You can kind of see the progression, right, of how it's going to get, you know, get to. And so for Jordy, for example, you know, I don't do a lot of form work with Jordy anymore, but every once in a while you'll have something, a habit creep in, and that happens with everybody, you know, so you kind of nip that in the bud, and then you kind of move on to, you know, with Jordy, you know, or kid like Jordy that we've seen in our program for a long time, it's more the mental side of the game that you're working with. And it's not like you call it a mental practice, but you are dealing with that. You know, you're saying the things that you want, because I want my voice basically in her ear if she's trying to do something on the mound. If she's struggling, you know, she needs to just think back, calm down, and go, okay, well, what would coach say here? You know, something that's familiar for her. So, you know, the mental side of the game is really, really big. And, you know, we've seen it with our teams. We've had some breakdowns on the mound, and Jordy will be the first one to tell you that she's had a breakdown on the mound. And I think there was one day she could have killed me because she wanted to come out. I think it was like 2 or 3 years ago. She was struggling, and, you know, I let her go, and she struggled, and to her credit, she came up with a pretty good answer. We had a team meeting after, and she said, I sucked out there. You know, that's basically, and so for her, it was how do I get my mind around what just happened, and what do I do tomorrow? You know, and she did an amazing job. She, yeah, didn't have a good day, you know, had to battle through it, and I'm not taking any credit for that, because I think she did an amazing job with it. And that's what we're trying to do with all of our players, right? Give them that fuel or whatever they need when they struggle, you know, and it doesn't have to be our voice. I said that a little bit funny, but it needs to be something that can calm her in a situation or calm our players when they need it. And that's on the mental side of it. You know, as they get a little bit older, we're dealing with that a lot more.
Yeah. The mental side's interesting because you said it pretty well. Pitchers have a really short memory, because you could have a bad outing at 10 o'clock and they give you the ball again at 6 and you have to go out there and do it again, right? You can't live in the bad outing, same as you can't live in a good outing. Just because you struck out 15 at 2 o'clock doesn't mean you're striking out anybody at 6 o'clock. So having that mental preparedness is critical. And I guess what you're saying, if I'm paraphrasing, as we advance in age and skill set and time, it's really important to work on the mental side of the game, because I can do it, get out there and throw, but what's your plan? Do you work with these athletes on a bit of a plan, how to set up hitters? Is there, you know, working with their best
absolutely
pitch?
And Razor's got a big part of that too, and when you say pitching, often you say catching, right? Because they're working with us, and the catcher's got to know what's going on, because I mean I don't know, the way it always worked with me is I told my catchers what I was throwing, you know?
Yeah,
and kind of how it
interesting.
Worked.
I've had the same philosophy that a really good catcher can make an average pitcher look pretty good out there. And so Razor's made a career of that, I would assume.
I was saying it the other way, Donnie.
Oh. Well, we'll get to Razor's point in a minute.
You only had one pitch.
Oh, come on.
Hey, good point, Razor. I know one thing I've heard a lot is when you talk to a pitcher, it could be 12, could be 14, and we'll say, okay, hey, what are you throwing? What's your best pitch? And they say, oh, I got a rise ball, I got a drop ball, I got a screw ball, I got two changeups, I got a curve ball. How many pitches do you think a pitcher should work on and get in their arsenal?
Who are you asking, me or Dino?
Dean. I'll ask you in a minute, oh. Razor.
Okay, well, I like the three. I like the big three, right? The drop ball, change up, and a rise ball, and in that order.
So
you're growing up.
You've had a pretty good career. Some would say, looking at your database here, your stats, and you were a three pitch guy, and you've won a ton of games. You've won a ton of worlds. You've won everywhere you can win with three pitches. I think the philosophy obviously is, hey, get real good at hitting spots, and then get real good at being, you know, one, two, and then three pitches. But any more than that, I don't know. I don't know if you can do it, great. But find the three you're really good at and use them.
I don't know, Donnie. I wish I would have kind of put more thought. I think everybody kind of thinks that way, you know, into my game when I actually played when it mattered. Or, you know, I know Dad did an amazing job, you know, with me as far as spin. You know, he really, really emphasized that, you know, spin and location is just as important as speed, if not more, right? So for me, Razor, and I know he's going to joke about this, but I didn't throw a rise ball until, you know, like I lost that. Like it was a good pitch for me in junior, and then when I put my foot back and I started throwing hard and throwing it by some guys, the changeup went out the window, and I never could get it back.
By so some guys, there, do you mean know? Every guy? When you throw 90 changeups, I mean, if you don't have to throw it, I've always kind of said changeup is a pitch that you earn as a hitter. If they're timing your hard stuff, and as you advance, everyone can get on to speed. It's then how do you change that speed and how do you change the levels? And when you're throwing 90, Dean, I don't think anyone needed to see a changeup from you.
Well, I'll give you an example. So I retired after 2012, so took 2013 off. Or something like that. I think 2014. I actually came back and played with Scarborough in 2015, right? And so my role on that team, because we had, you know, we had some pretty amazing pitchers out there. Actually, it was 2014, and we had Cheesy and Witty, and I think Carl Golan.
Woof,
so
that's a pretty
at that
good
time,
four.
Yeah, and at that time, Carl and I were there for color, you know, Witty and Kirkpatrick, we're going to do a bunch of the throwing, and we wanted to save Kirkpatrick against the Hill team, right? Hill United. They were the stack team. We didn't want to throw them out there to get beat up throughout the year, so we wanted to save it for the two tournaments that mattered. And really, I knew my role. And that was a tough one because I was on the other side for a long time, but I was to give Cheese some rest. And really, when I came back and played Hill, I didn't get give him much rest at all, because I think the first two times I played him, I only got through an inning or two, right? Like it was like tee off time. And it was because, you know, I'm thinking the same mentality. I'm going to throw out of 100 pitches, maybe 90 rise balls. And that had to change because I'd lost 4 or 5 mile an hour, right? So my game had to, I came back and the first thing I did was work on my changeup, right? And I played them again. I think I played them 3 times that year. And that was the only 3 losses that I had. And that was 2014 with the Gremlins. And that was because of that changeup and working it back and starting to realize how important that was. So, you know, fast forward and now we're working with kids. It's like, you guys don't lose that changeup. You know, Jordy's got a really, really nice rise ball. You know, she throws it hard. She wants to throw it every pitch. You know, it's a constant battle to make sure that she really, really works on that change, because at some point that's going to be the pitch that she's going to need to make the rise ball and the drop ball look so much better, right?
Well, so, it's funny you say that, because you look at like Jordy, yeah, she throws hard, her ball goes up, it moves. And I think as a pitcher, you get kind of in that, hey, I'm going to throw this hard, I'm going to get strike everybody out. That's, I think every pitcher feels that. But then you look at a pitcher like Ainsley, for example, whose best pitch by far is her changeup, and it sets up everything else, and it makes everything look harder, and it breaks down. She's got a fantastic changeup. And I think the longer you stick with that, the more you can mix up speed like that. It's devastating. As a hitter, it's impossible to get comfortable in the box when you have that thing floating in the background thinking, oh, here comes the yo-yo, and I'm going to look like an idiot walking off the diamond. Ainsley's done great at that, at working on the changeup and making that her feature pitch. You don't see that at this age very often where a U16 or U14 kid is like, yeah, I got a changeup, and it's real good, and I go to it 3-2. I go to it whenever.
Yeah, well, I say it quite often. I like to bring the example back to food. I'm not sure why, but you know,
we know
you're going to make your best, you know, your best meals. For me, it'd be like steak, pierogies, maybe a corn on the cob, right? So the steak for me is the drop ball. The pierogies, maybe that's the change up. You know, if you start adding things like the curveball or a screwball or those kinds of things. For me, that's like the parsley on the plate. That's the bun that gets half eaten, right? So you're right. I think for me, the focus is three pitches, and I start with drop ball. You know, a lot of them are saying it's a fastball, but 99 out of 100 kids, their natural pitch is a drop ball spin, right? So drop ball, then we change speeds, and then we start looking at spinning the ball and seeing what we can do as far as the rise ball goes.
Interesting. You had three pitches. I only ever saw one, and it just sounded like zip as it went by. I don't remember what it did, but I thought they're all the same. Interesting.
Yeah, now.
Well, anyway. Yeah. So I guess great, Dean, good insight on that. I know the pitcher-catcher relationship is super important. Trusting your catcher.
Yeah, thanks, Razor, for jabbing me.
Well, I can get
such a great relationship.
It's coming in here. Don't worry, Razor. But I mean, I know you said you like to tell the catcher what you're throwing. How much of your trust goes into a guy like Razor, who's been back there, seen all these hitters, and you just throw what he calls? Or how many times in a game do you think you would shake Razor off?
Not very often.
No.
You know, hardly ever. But, you know, the thing that pitchers, and you have to have a mind too. Like, I mean, an actual pitcher rather than just a hucker, right? Like, I know sometimes there's kids that, or pitchers, for example, it's not just kids. There's pitchers out there that should not be thinking about what they need to throw, right? Because it just, they don't need to think about that. That just clogs the brain up. And there's some pitchers that just go, give me the sign and let me throw it. And then there's some that are thinking pitchers, and they're like, okay, there's a little extra to this pitch. Well, she just swung and fouled this one off there. Maybe I got to move it up 6 inches. Well, Razor, that's not in a signal. He gives a one. Well, to me, I've got to go maybe 6 inches higher than we went last pitch, right? I know now, I mean, when I throw a pitch that's not very good, he doesn't have to say anything to me. He just looks at me and goes, yeah, I go, yeah. Right. So working with guys that you've worked with for a long time, like we had the show the other day, like with Obi, Razor's one of them, you know, Patty Shannon, those guys, when you get on the same page, it's awesome. And there's not a lot of thought process going on my part. You just let it ride. But, you know, every once in a while you get to a point where I feel more confident with one pitch, and that might be the time that I shake them off. But usually I'm saying, oh, sorry, maybe I should have went with what you called, because the last one you left the yard, right? So,
well, interesting you say Razor doesn't have to say anything, but what I know of Razor is I'm sure he does. Probably every time remind you that was a pretty bad idea to leave that pitch there. So let's get into Razor. Catching Razor obviously is your forte, the catching whisperer. Tell us a little bit about how you work with the kids in the program. On the catching skill set?
Well, when I'm working with the catchers, the main thing that I tell the catchers that they have to do is catch the ball. That's your number one job, is to catch the ball. So, you know, I start off with teaching them the stance, and, you know, I like building it up from the bottom up, right? So I like them to be comfortable in their legs, because, as you probably have seen, the squat is a little bit different than what people have been teaching and whatever else.
Razor squat is, right?
What's that?
Like your squat, the way you teach it is a little different.
Yeah, the way I teach it is a little different than everybody else's, for sure. And the reason that I do that is because I believe that the lower you are, the easier it is to catch the ball. And you can always go up on a pitch, but you can't always go down on a pitch. And I teach the kids to try and catch the ball with their fingers up as much as possible and you know, make it as easy to catch the balls. So, but basically right from their feet, that's where we start, and we move them up to throwing, to blocking, to all that kind of stuff. So
Razor, we talked a little bit about this already, but you've had the privilege of catching some of the greatest throwers that have ever been in the circle. Let's say Dean, for example, you're going to catch Dean. You've worked with him a million times. Do you guys have a bit of a pregame chat where, hey, this is working well, I want to go to this? Or do you just sort of wait and see how the game plays out?
When I'm catching it during warm-ups, and this is what I teach the older catchers now that are the older age, is watch the spins. Watch how the ball's spinning. Watch if it's moving, you know, that kind of stuff. And you should be able to tell during the warm-up which pitch is going to be the money pitch at the beginning of the game. Doesn't mean that pitch is going to be the money pitch by the end of the game, but the money pitch at the beginning of the game, you should be able to tell when you're warming up. So
catching, obviously, really critical in the game, especially as you advance. What is your take on the fact that, you know, we're working with, I'm not working with the catchers, but when you're working with a catcher, you obviously want them to be very vocal, to be kind of a leader in the infield, talking to the team, directing traffic, because they have the best view of the entire diamond in terms of, you know, when a ball gets hit in play, they know where everyone's going, where the throw is, where the cut is. How important is it, do you think, to teach early on how vocal these catchers need to be with their team?
Oh, I'm a firm believer that they got to be vocal for a couple different reasons. The biggest reason is if they're vocal and they're directing traffic, as you said, that allows them to be one step ahead of everybody, and know what play is coming where and stuff like that. Because this game happens fast, as you guys know. It's really quick, so. They have to understand the play that's in front of them, and plays change as it goes. You know, an error happens, the ball gets thrown somewhere else. So they have to be vocal, and they have to be directing traffic all the time. And they have to be a leader. And sometimes, you know, we get the mix up between being a leader and a bully, and so we have to straighten that out. But and lots of times it's about being a leader out there. So.
You know, I think the key to that too, Razor, we always talk about it, is yes, we want a vocal catcher, but you know, we've also had those vocal catchers that go, you know, base hit, throw to two. It's just the routine stuff that comes out of their mouth, and that's not really what we need. We need to understand the game, and so we're really, really focused with our team that we try to let them understand the game so they can talk through it and help everybody else. But the catcher's definitely got to start there for sure.
Well, we could debate back and forth. I know Razor will say catching is the most important. We want the smartest person on the field to be behind the plate. And I've been on these conversations. Hold on. I've been in these conversations where Tosh says the infielders are the most important and Dean wants to think the pitchers are the most important. Razor wants to think the catcher's the most important. But you want to develop someone to have a good ball sense. Some of that can't be taught. Some of it is already ingrained. But how do you work with catchers to help set up batters to hit spots? Where are they moving around? What are they seeing? What are you teaching these catchers at an early age and as they move up? And what are you making them look for behind the plate?
As far as batters, Donnie,
looking
at batters and. Well, you know, you watch their stance, you watch their hands, if they're dropping their hands, stepping in the bucket, diving into the ball. You know, we're watching all those kinds of things, getting them to understand the holes, right? and how we pitch to those holes and what advantages we can use with the pitcher that we got on the mound help me out. What's the word I'm thinking of?
Exploit those holes.
Exploit those holes. That's the one.
Well done.
For.
Good save.
Thanks. Thanks, Lynn. Yeah. That's exploiting the holes is the biggest thing for the catcher to find a weakness and to.
I like what you said, Razor, about understanding the pitcher that you have to work with, right? You know,
different thing every time a pitcher goes out on the mound, and it could be different every time the same pitcher goes out onto the mound. They
yes,
could be
we try not to have that happen. Yeah. But,
right. But they yeah. you know, you gotta kinda be kind of a psychologist out there and figure out, you know, do I scream at this pitcher today? Do I gotta coddle him today? You know, all them kinds of things because you can't treat everybody the same. Out on the mound, right?
So, I'm going to jump in here because I haven't talked for an hour.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, like, because we're talking about, obviously you're not going to talk to a 10-year-old like that, but what do you feel you are doing maybe differently than some other catching instructors? Because, you know, we see different videos, we see different stuff, and a lot of the stuff that we, and both Dino and Razor hit it on the head, we're going to talk about on the hitting thing too, is the one thing that we're trying to do in our program is teach the game, so the mental aspect and thinking. Do you think that's happening out there for the most part?
With the catchers, I think it is happening.
I think you're doing it. But what I'm just wondering, like,
what are the common things that you're dealing with?
What are the common areas that we're dealing with? Because I know, like, you know, I'm listening to you talk about holes and swings and stuff, and now we're talking Gaia, Bostock, Boehner, you know, the catchers, Gooch, that have come through the program. You got a 10-year-old that wants to catch. Where are you focusing on that?
Catch the ball. Don't be scared of the ball. Catch the ball. Yep. Start with their stance. Make sure they're comfortable in their feet. As you guys all know, when I'm doing catching, I work a lot on the legs. I'm a firm believer if your legs are tired, your mind's going to be tired, and you're not going to think. And in that kind of position that you're in as a catcher, you have to think. And so I teach that at a young level, at a young age, that you have to be comfortable in your legs. And you have to be able to be mobile behind there and, you know, strong. It's like a tree. You build the tree from the bottom up, right? So
Razor, interesting point. When you talk about your mind gets tired, do you find that catchers, and I'm not saying you, Razor, because you're the catching whisperer, but when catchers get tired, are they starting to call pitches that they'd rather catch or the ones that should be thrown because it's the best spot for the pitcher to throw it?
Ooh,
that's a great question.
What can you say and what can
I don't,
you say?
No example. I don't know. No examples. I'm not going to use any examples. As we all know, that when you get tired and your hand gets sore, and it's that drop ball's hard to catch, right? Because it's jamming you up and it's hard to catch. The biggest thing is I try and get the kids as prepared as possible for A, not being scared of the ball, and B, being able to catch the ball wherever it's thrown. So.
Okay, so another question, and this might be something that is a hot topic that some coaches agree, some don't, but what's the philosophy on getting catchers to start calling games? What age do you think that's important? Do you think it's important? Because you see a lot of coaches now are calling pitches. How important is it to you as a catcher to know what should be coming next on your own, or are you always wanting kids to look in the dugout and look for what you want them to throw?
Well, you know, when we first started this, we always thought that this was, you know, we're gonna teach the catchers to call the game, and they're gonna call the game, and they're gonna do that, right? But the problem that I've seen over the, you know, the previous years is, yeah, the catchers are calling the games, but are the pitchers hitting that spot? It's kind of tough to say you call the pitches and you know we'll work on the batters. If the pitchers throw the perfect pitch every single time and the catcher calls you know, the pitch that they want, well, then we know the catcher made a mistake. But it's a tough position to be calling pitches and wondering if the pitcher hit the spot or, you know. Help me out with that, Dino. You know
well,
where I'm going with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing is, how do you, you know, when you're, everybody knows when you're coaching, it's nice to have three or four coaches on the bench. You know, a lot of times we're going down there, we have two coaches on the bench. You know, if we had Razor there to call every pitch for every one of our players, not saying that we would obviously do it because we want to develop those catchers, but what's happening right now is you have catchers that'll, you know, there's times we'll let them go call the game, but we don't, maybe there isn't that pitch that we wanted to go talk to them about because we don't have the time because we're now we're hitting and you got to go take their base or you got to, you know, so you don't get that time. Like if you worked with that catcher the whole game, then I think they'd get a lot out of it. But right now we're kind of battling with the fact that, so we get them calling their game and they understand it and they're doing a heck of a job. And then they go to college or some of these different teams even around in our area where they call all the pitches from the bench. And it's like, you're trying to develop these catchers to have a mind of their own and to really, really work on getting the most out of their pitchers. And then all of a sudden, poof, they go back to college and it's like, they don't get to do it anyway. I still think overall our players will get more out of that because they understand, but I think it's a real, real onus on the coach to make sure that they're following up with the great calls that they make and the ones that maybe aren't so good, right?
Well, and the other thing that I find when catchers are calling their own games is they're staying in the game more. They're watching batters more. They're understanding, you know, at the very high level, we're teaching them, okay, we want a ground ball to the right side of the field. Well, the way we're going to do that is throw a drop ball on the outside corner to a righty, right? So they start understanding the game more when they're calling the pitches. And, you know, we've been fortunate that we've had some
pretty
good catches.
It's important to note that they became great working with you as much as they did. That's a little tire pump from my roomie Razor right there. But I guess the underlying philosophy is you want the catchers to, even if they're not calling the pitches, to know what should be thrown at a certain time. Because you're right, club teams, college coaches, it's all different. But I think it's important that there's no better view of the batter than the person sitting 2 feet behind him. And as a coach myself, I can't see from the dugout, you know, inside, outside, where their hands are, what they're doing. The catcher has a great view of that. So I think it's really an important skill set to get catchers to start looking at it and thinking about what the next pitch should be based on their last swing, their last at-bat. Catchers have the best seat in the house. I mean, so I get it that not all coaches agree, and a lot of coaches want to call that pitch themselves. But you said it yourself. You can call a pitch all you want. The catcher, your coach, it doesn't matter. If it gets missed, it doesn't matter who's calling it. If it's a bad pitch, it's a bad pitch.
Right, and it helps us as coaches to know whether the pitchers are throwing to that position if we're calling the pitches right. So, it's more about follow up about following up with the catchers and making sure that they understand why they're calling those pitches is the biggest thing I think.
Really,
when we got into the tournaments, Razor, and we got into the finals or Sunday, and we've had Razor sit down and make those calls, it's definitely gone a lot better for us.
100%.
Right? And that's not a knock against our catchers. It's just...
it's confidence.
And
right?
And I think they learn a lot, too. They'll see Razor call 3 changeups in a row, and in their mind they're going, why are they calling this? And the pitcher's thinking, why are they calling 3 changeups in a row? And then all of a sudden you see the batter fall down swinging at it, and it's like, oh, okay, you can do that, right? Because, you know, again, in the girls' game, you don't see a lot of back-to-back or even 3 changeups in a row, whereas on the guy's side of it, that happened quite often. Right?
Well, it's important you notice, Razor, too. You said preparation in the warm-up is critical. I mean, talk about a guy like Dean who said his drop ball was his best pitch, his rise ball was a strikeout pitch. But then if he's warming up and the spin's not there, you can show up to a game as a pitcher and your spin just isn't there. And so recognizing that before the game starts that, hey, let's maybe call the 2 more than the 1 this game because it's just not working. Let's go to this more. But that changes every game.
I don't know, Donnie.
Sure.
I think at a young level it does, but as you're, like, if I make a bad rise ball pitch, my spin isn't bad. You know, like,
no.
like, and that's where I see where kids are really starting to get it on the pitching side of it. Sorry, I know my pitching stuff's done, but say you got a pitcher that she's finally got the rise ball. That spin doesn't usually spin right one time, and then she throws it low and it doesn't spin that way. It's usually consistently she's got it. And to me, that's when that pitch now is, that's a game pitch. You can get in there and start, you know, being confident with it because your spin is your spin. Look, where I suck, you know, if I'm having a bad day, it's going to be, oh, geez, I'm throwing that pitch right down the middle, or it's location to me, right? The spin should be there.
Dino, that the ball will move more where we throw the location, right? So if the location, if we're having trouble with the location, that ball's not going to move as much as it would if we threw it at a higher location using the rise ball as an example,
sure.
Right? So
just a quick sidebar, Dean, what was your go-to strikeout pitch?
Seriously?
Yeah, I'm setting you up. It's coming.
Well, I would say rise ball. If I threw probably 100 pitches in a game, there's 90 rise balls for sure.
Which decade, Donnie?
Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough. I mean, my next question was going to be, obviously, it's a no-brainer by setting you up. You know, you elevate a little bit. The ball's going super fast. Guys are closing their eyes and swinging. At least I did. It didn't work. But did you set that up with low rise? I mean, that's probably, and I'm going to ask you,
isn't this a catching part?
Hold on. I'm going to get back. I'm circling back. Just give me a minute.
Is
that something that you set up a low rise in the same spot you'd start a drop, and then just if they miss, you go up and up and up? And then is that Razor's job to say, hey, this guy, Donnie Atkinson, at the plate, he hasn't touched a ball in a decade. Let's just keep throwing it here above his hands and just keep going. Or do you have a different idea of, because I know your rise ball, a low rise is a really tough pitch to throw. It looks like a drop coming in, and then it goes up, and hitters are now they're guessing. How much faith do you put in a guy like Razor to know when you want to throw that pitch and when you want to start elevating that pitch?
He'll give me the little sign, you know, he'll give me the one, and if he wants it up higher, he'll give me the little, you know, flick of the wrist there, and he'll tell me to get it up a little higher. And so, I mean, that's usually, that's where you're on the same page with your catcher. Very rarely do they have to do that. You know, it might be like a key at bat, key hitter, whatever, and Razor will give me the one, and he'll, okay, you know, give him the motion to make sure you get it up kind of thing. Right. And, you know, but that doesn't happen every pitch, right? It happens key at bats. But I mean, I'm an advocate of a guy, you know, if you're pitching and you're pitching to a hitter, they got to hit it. Like if you can throw rise ball after rise ball and they just swing through it, why give them a chance to hit something different? You know, like that's not the case with everybody, but you know, there are hitters that you just know that person can't hit a rise ball, right?
They can't hit it and they can't lay off it is the issue. I've had
so until they make an adjustment, you don't have to, right?
Right. We talked about it earlier.
That's a good point, Dino, because you remember me telling the catchers down in the state, our catchers down in the States, you know, until they make that adjustment on that outside corner, we're not going away from it, right? Like we're gonna use that outside corner drop ball as much as we possibly can until they adjust to it.
That was with old Katie Heal.
You know, that was another experience that Michaela Smith learned a lot that weekend. So
Katie Heal, talk about another changeup that's pretty tough to pick. It's her changeup. It's terrible, and it makes her other stuff look like it's coming 10 miles an hour harder, because you're always thinking in the back of your head, well, here comes the Nintendo ball, the up and down 20 mile an hour changeup, and now you're embarrassed. No one wants to be embarrassed. And like hitting is all about timing. Pitching is all about upsetting timing. That's a great, great job. We're going to talk about Tatosh now, because I know he's chewing on his hands.
If only we had a hitting instructor on.
I know, and he's been chewing on his hands the whole time, just waiting to get his chance. Here's your chance, Tosh. Talk about hitting. We'll get into the same questions. You work with 10 U10s, U19s, all the way up. What's the fundamental approach you try to give them to instill in them at a young age, and then how do you advance it as they progress?
Well, are these two guys done talking about how good they were?
Yeah,
okay. All right.
For now.
Oh, come on.
Well, I just think, like,
when we're talking about kids, and this is kind of the whole impetus of this podcast or this session, it's that progression on where you're taking them, and hitting is one of those things where I think Dino talked about it, the mechanic side. When they're really young, the biggest thing I want to see out of the really young hitters is that they're aggressive, because when they're young, they're that 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. It's all about the result, and a lot of times a result can come off as being a positive. So I always talk about the example where you get a kid up there that's not aggressive, and all they're trying to do is hit the ball, and they hit the ball, and they hit it back to the pitcher, and the pitcher picks it up and airmails it over first base, and they get to first base, right? And the misnomer is that...
Why did you say the pitcher?
Well, stay with me here. So they throw it over first base, and then the misnomer is that was a good play because I'm standing at first base. When in actuality, when they get older and they hit it back to the pitcher, it's an out, right? Because I find that young hitters just aren't progressed through to that point where they need to get more aggressive. So that's one of the things I talk about with the younger hitters for sure. There's some mechanical stuff. Yeah, you want to see some weight transfer. You want to see some backside drive, all that good stuff. And if there's something that's really glaring, then we'll address it. But when they're really young, I just want to get up there and have a good hack. And we use the term swing with violence. We talk about swinging with violence. We talk about making sure we're in control, all that sort of stuff. But I want to make sure that the kids get aggressive, because just putting the ball in play is not good enough. As you get older, it's not good enough. So when dealing with younger hitters, that's what I'm looking at, making sure they're swinging hard, making sure they're swinging at strikes, because that's the other thing, and Dino would attest to this, that young pitchers don't throw a lot of strikes. So this game is really boring as a hitter if there aren't a lot of strikes, because you're just walking to first base all the time. So that's one of the things that I find is tough to teach the kids when we have them, is to just get really aggressive. The other thing we talk about is, it's okay to strike out. It's okay to swing hard and miss, as long as you're swinging at strikes. Because we get these athletes that are pretty good athletes, and on any given night, they're 5 for 5, 6 for 6. But as they start to get older, then the pressure to succeed and show those good results all the time is there, because they're wondering, well, in U12, I went 6 for 6 every day, and now I go to U14, U16, and I'm 2 for 6. And it's talking them through that whole process. So once we get into the older age groups, then I think I get into a little bit more about mechanics and making sure we got the good backside drive and our hands are above the ball and all those good things that we talk about. And I won't get into too many specifics here. But the one thing that I talk about the most with all levels of hitters is the head. Your head has to be in the middle. And if your head is moving around, it's going back and forward and up and down, it's really hard to hit because your eyes are moving all over the place. So the quieter they are in their stance, the quieter they are in their swing, keeping their head in the middle. If they can keep your head in the middle of your swing, everything else should be balanced. You should be in a good spot.
You touched on a good point. Tosh, sorry to interrupt. You touched on a good point, swing with violence. I was going to lead you into that, but you brought it up. You know, a lot of, especially in the younger groups, you hear this, hey, just put it in play, from the fans, from the coaches, but you make a good point. A 20 bouncer to the second baseman to throw it at first is no different than a strikeout when you're swinging as hard as you can. I think the philosophy, obviously, is anytime you swing your bat, try and put a good swing on the ball as hard as you can, because you want to hit the ball hard. Just touching the ball is not good enough.
If you miss, you want the pitcher to go, oh my God, if they would have hit that, it would have gone a mile.
Well,
right?
We talk about in the men's game, a lot of hitters, and Tosh, I'm sure you did this, and Dean, I know you did this, you'll swing at the first pitch as hard as you can. Doesn't matter where it goes, hoping that the catcher and pitcher are thinking, oh, well, here comes a changeup. And the batter is baiting them to throw that pitch, and now you sit on it. That's getting into a pretty advanced sort of hitting approach. But how much do you talk to these young athletes about, hey, what kind of approach do you have at the plate? Because I know as a coach for me, when I work with hitters, I'll say, hey, what pitch do you like to hit the most? And almost all of them at first say, oh, the one down the middle, which doesn't generally, shouldn't happen anymore. So, you know, we want to try and talk to them about, hey, here's a plan. Look for the pitch that you hit the hardest. And when you get it, swing as hard as you can. You get 3 strikes. You don't have to swing at the first strike you see. So have a plan when you go up there, and don't just make yourself, don't make it easier on the pitcher.
Well, I think it depends, like Dino was talking on the pitchers, it depends on the hitter, because I could have that same conversation with a national team player and they don't get it. So you have to kind of adapt as a hitting coach. You're adapting to, if you can, to each individual kid. Yeah, the plan is this. The plan is simple. When you're a young hitter, even for an older hitter, the plan is simple. Swing at strikes, hit it as hard as you can. There's nothing more simple than that. All the mechanics, everything else that goes into that on the hitting side is all part and parcel of that. But when you get to the plate, you shouldn't be thinking about, am I backside drive? Do I have good weight transfer? Is my head in the middle? All that stuff has to be practiced to the point where it becomes second nature. And then if they're putting the practice in, we want to make sure they're putting in the proper practice. But the bottom line is, I don't think it's easier to try and talk to some of these more advanced hitters, but I think of even the most advanced hitters that I've ever dealt with, if you try and talk them into what you're talking about, setting up a hitter, they don't get it.
No.
They don't get it. So where the philosophy comes in, where my hitting philosophy comes in, we're dealing with the athletes at the ages that we're dealing with and the developmental situations that we have, it's make sure you're swinging at strikes. If you get a strike, hit it as hard as you can. The next point is what you brought up, Donnie. Okay, understand what is your favorite pitch to hit. What is your pitch to hit? And I work in the four quadrants, down and in, down and away, up and in, up and away. And you're right, never down the middle, because I don't think any pitching instructor on the planet tells their pitchers to throw the ball down the middle. So you're right, I don't want to hear that. However, it's to the point where if you're even asking them to look for their favorite pitch to hit, sometimes that's even way beyond what they're thinking at the time. So I try and keep it as real simple as possible, right? And then it's knowing situations as well, right? Like as you get advanced in a game, you're knowing certain situations as far as, you know, be ready. If you got a bunt and you're in a bunting situation, be ready to do that. All the mechanics that go with that. But I think that what I see too on a lot of sides, as we start to develop our athletes through, and I've kind of done a 180 on this one, and I've talked to you guys about this before. There's so much emphasis, and don't get me wrong, I want to qualify this. There's so much emphasis, though, on mechanics in hitting that we forget about the mental side. We forget about it's okay to fail. It's okay to strike out. And putting them in a mental state where they're relaxed when they get to the plate, because we've all seen it. We have a kid at the plate who's got maybe the most beautiful swing you've seen in your life. They swing at a pitch or swing through a rise ball or miss a pitch, and they look down at you at third base and go, what did I do wrong? Well, you missed the ball. But that's not because you don't have a bad swing. It's because maybe you weren't mentally ready for that. Maybe the timing was off, like you talked about, Donnie. So my approach to hitting has gone right from, let's get the mechanics as they start to get older, get the mechanics going, and then really ramp up the mental side. And just about getting them relaxed and comfortable in the box.
Okay, so another question would be, we work on the tee a lot with this program, and I think the tee is really good for mechanics and getting your swing straight. And then talk about the difference between instructing off a tee and then instructing off a live. And I don't want to get too much into how great of a batting practice pitcher you are, but the difference between the two, what is it and what's your philosophy on it?
Well, I think it goes right back from when we were growing up. We never hit off pitching machines ever. We always hit off a live arm, and that was Dean's dad, right? Mm-hmm. So even when I'm doing lessons, we never use a machine in this program. And I mean, not the machines are bad. It's they're good for reps, but the thing that I find is you have to be able to read the ball off the hip, and it's a timing thing. And whereas
most machines don't spin right, they don't, you know.
Well, and they're always
even
right.
The ones you, yeah.
Well, they're always right down the middle.
Yeah,
right?
The problem with
I see it all the time where you've got, and I'll watch people do lessons. They set the machine up to throw the thigh high dipper right down the middle. Okay, well that's awesome if you're looking to get your reps, but if all you do is hit off a machine and then you put that kid into a game with a live arm, you know what you're going to find 9 times out of 10? Just scared of the ball. Because the ball isn't in that same spot all the time. So I find that with young hitters that grow up just hitting off machine, 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 if they don't see the ball off a live arm, they're in a lot of trouble.
Well, the problem
is that
with
the hitting, they got to get hit once in a while, too.
Exactly. Do you find that kids, you know, at what age do they start realizing, like, I like to think of everybody's got a hole in their swing somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, we all know about our own swings, and we, you know what to look for and what to try and guard against. A lot of the kids, I mean, obviously just because they're young and not quite experienced enough with it, but when they start, for me, when I see they start realizing that they need to protect certain things or their open stance gives them this weakness, and they start to get that, that's when you start, is that correct? I mean, that's when I start to see the kids blossom a little bit as far as becoming a hitter, because they recognize their own swing and where their limitations are and their strengths.
Well, and we've all seen it, and you're right. Like, that's when you start to talk about the different holes in the swing, and your swing is your swing. And now it's not so much about what do you do well, it's what do you guard against. Like, a good coach or pitcher-catcher combo, like you guys were talking about, is going to see a hole, right? And whatever that hole is, you need to be able to defend it. And by defending, it means don't swing at a pitch there with less than 2 strikes. You can't, because you're getting yourself out. Unless you adjust to make the adjustments or learn to hit that pitch, why are you swinging at it, right? When you got 2 strikes, you got to foul it off. You got to do whatever you got to do. But here's the biggest thing that I find with young hitters, guys, and this is the other thing that I started talking to hitters about, or, you know, different teams that I work with, not just our kids, is anytime a coach or a hitting instructor says something to you, and I will never ever say, do this. I will say, try this. If they don't answer with the question, why, then we might as well be talking to the wall, because we've all seen it. They all nod their head and go, yeah. They don't get it. They don't understand it. But if you explain the why part, then hopefully some of that sticks. And that's what I found now. When we start dealing with our teams and those hitters that are starting to get a little older in age, the ones that really want to get better are the ones that start to give.
They understand it.
Yeah. They understand it, and they understand why we're asking them to do something. So, I mean, that's kind of the whole Coles Note gamut that you run through as a hitting instructor. But again, it's very individual, and there's no cookie cutter way to do it. And I see this all the time, and I've heard about it where different coaches have said, all my team are going to hit like this. Well, that's tough, because you're going to have athletes that can't hit like that. And I have athletes coming to me all the time saying, well, Tosh, my coach is asking me to do this and this and this. My answer is this: you're playing for that coach, then you need to either find a happy medium or talk to that coach or try what they're offering. But I will defy anybody out there to find a coach that will change a kid's swing if they're hitting 600.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you talk about any team you've ever played on, you don't want to build an army of Tosh lookalikes out there, because body types come into play, strength, quick. That's not a shot. I just mean, like, you look at
it is. It's awesome.
It's not meant to be. But I mean, like, you can give them the skills, but you can't have 15 kids just looking to try and do the exact same. Oh, the Tosh did this, so I'm going to try that. Everyone's a little bit different. Pitching's the same. You can't build an army of 5 pitchers and say, well, just do it exactly this way and you'll be fine, because it comes in terms of body type, arm length, leg drive. They all act a little different. You just want to give them the basic, hey, here's the approach. But you're right. There's a lot of ugly swings in the Hall of Fame. We've all said it before. Yep. If you're batting 600, don't come to me. You're doing fine.
That's right.
And the thing about hitting that's interesting is, ball is a majority fail sport. Like, even the best hitters go out 6 out of 10 times. Doesn't mean they had 6 bad at bats. It means either they put a good swing on the ball, it got caught, they struck out. Doesn't mean it's bad. You got to get pretty comfortable with the fact that you're not going to get a hit every time. No one's gone a weekend and went 20 for 20. It's never happened. And Tosh might say he did it one time. I'm sure he will.
He didn't.
Fair. But that's the 19. Thing. You got to be comfortable with the fact that, hey, what happened on that at bat, and what can I change to my next at bat to know that that's not going to happen again? But it's never It's not an exact science. You can't say,
yeah,
well, if I just do what Tosh said, I'm going to go 10 for 10.
But that goes back to pitching, catching, fielding. It goes back to everything that when we are talking to kids in our program or kids on our teams, the message is the same. It's the process. Working on the process. If you have a good process, which means your mechanics are pretty good, pitching, catching, whatever it happens to be, chances are the results are going to be better more often than they're not. But unfortunately, what happens is we get process driven. So in the hitting side, when we get nervous, we get handsy, right? We're just trying to eye-hand coordination, just trying to hit the ball. We lose all that flow because it's hit the ball, hit the ball, hit the ball, hit the ball. Unfortunately, what happens then is that is rewarded. That is rewarded by mostly it's rewarded by parents. I'll say it. And I know you all cringe when I say it, but it's true. But what is really cool is when you are dealing then with parents or with players that understand that, you know what, I would rather hit two absolute laser beams right at the shortstop, they made a great play, than to hit one back at the pitcher where they picked it up and threw over the first baseman's head, and I was safe.
Yeah, it's a good point. I always ask the players I work with, if you barrel the ball and they make a play on it, that's still a good at bat. The result wasn't what you wanted, but that goes a foot the other way and you're standing on third base. I'd rather have the athletes who look at that and say, yeah, that's a good at bat, rather than the one that they nub off the end of their bat that floats over the second baseman's head and they think, ooh, I got on base. Yeah, getting on base is great, but we're focusing on the at bat and the process and barreling the ball.
Try and convince a young kid that a 12-pitch at bat that you end up striking out on with a great swing is a good at bat.
Yeah, it's impossible. But as a coach, you're thrilled. You're watching them battle results.
Yep.
You think, man, you just saw 12 pitches. You saw everything this athlete can throw at you. You saw it all.
How about Brooke Melinchuk's at bat in the final game last year?
Fantastic.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, awesome.
And it wasn't the result she wanted, but it was a fantastic friggin' at bat.
See, that's the funny thing you guys talk about, and we've all talked about it, is you get these athletes that come to winter training or come to team tryouts, and they're all great. They're all good ball players. They've all earned the right to be there. And then now you got to focus on, hey, the mental side. This game, you can love the game all you want, and some days it doesn't love you back. Doesn't mean you're a bad hitter. Doesn't mean you had a bad day. You put a good swing on the ball, and they made a play. That's not a bad result. It's a bad result, but it's not a bad at bat. And there's a huge difference, because I know the emotion side on the female game, it's instant. And I know I've struck out so many times that it's just become I struck out. When are we going to the tent? And you sort of bury it and think, well, it's still a good game, team won, whatever. But I know the emotion is instant on this side where they think, oh, I popped out or I struck out. Yeah, you better get ready, because you're getting another bat.
Our program, Donnie's focused on that. It's like Tosh said, it's the process, right? We don't have too many things that we do, like especially our winter training and camps. That's all we're focused on is that process. Right. And very little, like we go to tournaments, of course we want to win ball games, but for our program, it's not the be all end all to win it. Our focus is still to make the kids better, to get them to where they want to go. Right. So it's not necessarily that, you know, like we don't keep their averages all year, you know, or throughout the program. It's irrelevant to us. Right. We're focused on the process, and we need to help them be prepared for times when they struggle right at the plate. And that's I think that's actually makes it a little easier for our process rather than say a coach that, you know, say a college coach where they're winning and losing is their job, right? The result maybe is a little bit different for them, right? So there's a little more pressure there that they put on the kids. But anyhow, for us, I think it's a little easier.
No, for sure. A lot of good points. I love that we talked about a lot about philosophy and each of the components, pitching, catching, hitting. I think, you know, we're over an hour here. I think it's a good cast. I think we've got so many more topics we can break into in the next one. Razor, awesome to have you. Love having – the one thing I want to leave with, you talk about being vocal. And anyone listening to the podcast who's ever gone to a team practice or a winter training or any event where Razor is in the crowd – the one rule the twos have is it doesn't matter where you're going, run there. Always be running. And you might hear Razor say, what?
Stop.
Stop. And he yells stop, and everybody's got to drop and do push-ups. And it's almost to the point now where it's comical. Razor's looking for people to be ambling
along. Oh, yeah, he's got a Hawkeye out there.
Oh, it's something. It's amazing to be able to see 30 kids at once. But Razor does it. And the old fisheye gets out there, and Razor yells,
stop.
Stop. And then everyone knows, ah. And then we're getting to the point now where first few events I went to, whether it was winter training or practice, there's four, five, six times where Razor's yelling,
stop.
Thank you. And now it's to the point where it's hard to even find anybody who is walking between, which is a huge part of the – we talk about philosophy. Well, the two's philosophy is always, you know, always be moving, always be running.
That's something that they – sorry to interrupt, but that's something that they can control. They can control that effort that they bring every day, right? And that's something really big that we push with these kids as well, is they don't need to control their talent
to try hard.
That's right, and that's a great philosophy. And you see it now. Everyone runs between stations. They're grabbing their gear. They're getting in, and they're running. It looks awesome. On the field, at practice, in a game, always looks sharp when everyone's running. So I really appreciate everybody's time. Great, great insight on the positions and the specific drill sets. Does anyone have any parting shots, we're calling it, at the end of the podcast? I'll start with you, Dino.
Well, I mean, this is our squad. This is where we started with Razor, Tosh, and I, and now Donnie, right? Being our hostess with the Moses here. I enjoy it. This is a lot of fun. I didn't know exactly kind of how it was going to go, but I love talking ball, and hopefully the listeners out there enjoy it. And I guess the next stage is to have a phone-in show so they can phone in and ask you questions, Tosh.
Well, that would have to be a live show.
Yeah, it would be something. Well, you know what? Everyone listening, if you're a player, if you're a parent, if you're an alumni, you may get asked a couple days out, hey, we're having a podcast, love to have you on. So be prepared. Because, I mean, getting our insight is one thing, but hearing from someone who's been in the program and played and is still in it, let's say, or someone who's graduated from the program, gone on to college, it's awesome to hear their experience and how this program helped them get to where they are now. So I think that's a great segue, honestly. We could talk all day. This is just like us sitting in the tent after a game. And I think it's hopefully it's giving the listeners a little bit of a ball fix while we're all waiting to get back on the diamond. So I really appreciate that, Dean. That's great. Razor, what do you got?
I don't have a lot. I just remember when the guys called me and said, hey, we're going to run this and we need a catching instructor. Would you be interested? And I'm like, yeah. Sure, and here we are 6 years later, and I just want to say thanks, guys.
The program saved your life. You're not smoking anymore. Well, he's not
anymore.
Oh, he's not going to save his life. He's still going to die. He's just going to die 4 years later.
That's right. I'm like, yeah.
Extended your life. That's a nice thing. Yeah. Though. That's nice.
Yeah. That is a big deal.
Yeah.
Extended my life.
I'd like to have you around for a few more years, Razor.
And we haven't hacked on Razor at all. That's pretty good. That's probably a first. No, this whole podcast, really. Really.
Oh.
And normally everybody's, you guys are so tough on Razor, blah, blah, blah. I will make my parting shot. I will make a comment around Razor was right. We phoned him up and said, hey, we need a catching instructor. Ten people have turned us down. And
you didn't tell me that part.
No, Razor, we love you, buddy.
I'll send in my letter of resignation again.
Again.
It's called resignation, not resignation.
No, it's okay. We have the first three.
Okay, good.
Yeah, we can just reinstate them whenever you want.
As Razor's roommate, I got to take his back here a little bit. Best roomie in the league, snacks for days, always a good TV show on, guy's a beauty. But I think we can all agree, Razor comes off as the roughest but all the kids, anyone who's been in the program, anyone who's ever worked with them, loves Razor, speaks nothing but the highest praise for Razor and what he does. So I, as a roomie buddy, I really appreciate everything you bring to this group.
Thanks, guys. Big heart for the game, big heart for the kids.
Thanks for listening to Two's Talk with Tosh, Dino, and Donnie.